Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Since our last recording, Jimmy Buffett passed away at 76. Buffett lived in Florida, of course, for a time. He was not a Floridian or even a particularly a long-time Florida resident, Craig, but undoubtedly he and his music were connected to the state.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was in Key West, at the invitation of, he was broke. He had nowhere to go. His friend, Jerry Jeff Walker, said, "I'm going down to Key West. Come with me." and he drove down there and wound up sticking around. And he really liked the island vibe there. And that sort of turned his life around. You know, he started out playing for tips, basically, in Key West, and then parlayed that into this whole career of five decades that wound up with him being worth $1 billion.
Yeah, I mean, it's an empire. I mean, he's a billionaire. There's no question. When you know, it's not just the licensing of the music and all the merchandise and the concerts, the live events, which maintained their popularity with that, you know, cult following till the very end. It's the beer, the restaurants, and then these hotel resorts, retirement communities. I mean, the guy was a real estate mogul at the end. Amazing. And your column this week at FloridaPhoenix.com focuses about Buffett and his conservation ethic. But you share a remarkable story in there that you saw him perform live in college when you were at Troy in Alabama.
Yeah. That was just sort of my funny way of getting into the subject. But yeah, this was 1979. This was the second rock concert I ever went to. And I really didn't know much about Buffett at the time. And what sticks out in my memory is not necessarily Buffett's performance, but the fact that one of my classmates was singing, a very straight laced young woman was singing along very enthusiastically to a song that she thought was called "Why Don't We Get Drunk at School?" Which
why don't we get drunk at school is why don't we get drunk and screw. And I've got a funny story about that song as well, because even growing up in Wisconsin, you know, my mom is 78 now, but has always loved Florida. Went to spring break in Fort Lauderdale from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and has always had this love affair with Florida, which is passed on to me, and why I moved here and why she lives here now. And she had a Jimmy Buffett tape that we would, my brother and I and her, while we're, you know, running errands and going to soccer games in the 80s, she would play. And it was a greatest hits tape. So it's got, you know, Volcano and Fins and Cheeseburger in Paradise and all that kind of stuff on it. But there was one song on the tape she would always have to fast forward because my brother and I were 11, 12 years old at this time. And that, of course, was "Why Don't We Get Drunk and Screw?" But that was in Wisconsin, you know, and my mom, you know, was just so attracted to Florida and this beach atmosphere, this attitude, this lifestyle that Jimmy Buffett captured perfectly, that you know, even in Wisconsin, he was a part of my life.
Yeah. So did you know about his effort with manatees? I mean, did that
I think maybe in our manatee episode, it came up briefly, but your column really does a remarkable job detailing his conservation ethic, particularly with manatees, and how he was more than just a celebrity face, famous spokesperson, give some money to the effort to protect the manatees. He was deep in with this for 40 plus years.
Yeah. I mean, he met with Bob Graham, then the governor of Florida, backstage after a concert in Tallahassee in 1981. And he had sung a song called "Growing Older But Not Up" that mentions manatees that have scars. And he and Graham started talking and came up with the idea for what became the Save the Manatee Club. And Graham named him the chairman. And that's a job he held for the next 42 years until he died last week. Yeah. And he was not just, as you mentioned, he was not just a celebrity face. He came up with the idea for their Adopt a Manatee program. He came up with the idea of posting warning signs at marinas and docks.
I think that's amazing. The idea you see Fernandina Beach here, all the boat ramps, you know, caution for manatees. You know, that's Jimmy Buffett's idea.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
And then he donated money to get them started posting the signs. I mean, it's just, and he did lots of public service announcements about him. And
yeah. And I think, you know, that was something that was even, again, even as an 11, 12 year old listening to Margaritaville and A Pirate Licks in 40 and all the, you know, the hits. I'm not the deep cut guy. I don't go to the Buffett concerts, all that kind of stuff. But anyone who loves the water that much, loves the ocean that much, it was even clear to me then that he had a conservation ethic. And I think that's lost a little bit in what that whole beach lifestyle, let's just sit around and flip flops and drink beer and you know, do nothing all day musical genre Kenny Chesney has become. You know, there was some real meat behind that for Jimmy Buffett. It wasn't just sit around all day and have a good time and get drunk.
Yeah. And I mean, and he was so involved that one of the stories I tell is about when the board of directors came up with this idea in 1999 that, hey, we're going to have to sue the federal government and the state government because they are clearly violating the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act in regards to manatees. And Buffett said, okay, but there's a new governor in Florida. We need to go warn him that this is coming and he can make changes if he wants to. And so they went to he and Pat Rose, the executive director of Save the Manatee Club, went and met with Jeb Bush. And Bush was supposed to have been briefed about it. And instead, nobody had told him, hey, these guys are coming here to talk about a lawsuit. And the minute they mentioned lawsuit, Bush lost it. He just jumped up and yelled, lawsuit. And they somehow had to get through the rest of the meeting. But I mean, Buffett didn't have to do that. He didn't have to do that kind of stuff, but he was actively involved. And that's what he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. Greg's column has any number of wonderful anecdotes like that from Buffett's history of conservation around the manatees, the column floridaphoenix.com. Want to thank our friends at windstormproducts.com. Windstormproducts.com started as a local family company here in Florida along the Treasure Coast area. It has grown to become the largest online retailer of hurricane hardware. And that's all the nuts and bolts and screws and wig nuts and fasteners that protect your home and patio furniture and shutters and everything else from hurricane wind damage. Visit windstormproducts.com and see how they can help you protect your home from the effects of hurricane wind damage.
As Jimmy would tell you, there's no way to reason with hurricane season.
Good one. As extreme coincidence would have it, Craig, we are talking about the Florida Keys today.
Yes, we have historian Brad Bertelli with us to tell us all about conchs, not conches, conchs. So be conscious of how you refer to conchs in Key West.
and we are talking about Jimmy Buffett, who is so closely associated with Key West. And Craig scheduled this interview 3-4 months ago. So it is a remarkable bit of...
It's a conch coincidence.
it absolutely is. Brad Bertelli runs a great Facebook page all about Florida Keys history. It's Florida Keys History with Brad Bertelli on Facebook. I'll put a link to that and his website, bradbertelli.com, in the show notes. One of the go-to Florida Keys historians, Brad Bertelli, joins us on the podcast this week.
Brad, thanks so much for joining us today. Let me start off with the most basic question of all. Do you say conch or conch?
Conch, like bonked on the head. Saying conch is one of those dead giveaways that you don't know quite what you're talking about.
So explain to people what that is and how it became a term for people in Key West.
Well, the conch is a sea snail. Primarily when you talk about conch in the Florida Keys, we're talking about the queen conch. And that's the symbol that kind of represents not just Key West, but the Florida Keys and the conch republic. Now, there's a little bit of debate as to why conch became a terminology for the people, not just in the Florida Keys, but from the Bahamas, where they first originated. Sometimes it's because it was such a prime food source. That's kind of like the general term, is that they ate so much conch that they became known as conchs.
I'd be called a mullet then, coming from the Let me start off with my classic question, which is how do you cook them and how do they taste?
I've never had fresh conch, which is supposed to be really tasty because it's been illegal to harvest conch from local waters and state and federal waters since the 1970s commercially and then recreationally in 1980s. But the most general preparations, everyone's had a conch fritter. Everyone's had that yummy conch chowder. conch salad, which is basically conch ceviche, where that, you know, diced up with, you know, raw with some fresh lime to cook the meat with some tomato and onion and pepper. Always delicious.
What is the Bahamian connection to this story that you mentioned?
Originally, and we're talking about conchs, we're talking about white people who moved initially from England, Britain, London to the U.S. And during the Revolutionary War, the people who were loyal still to Britain moved to the Bahamas, and they became known kind of, and that's where the first conchs were. Oh. And later on in the story, the conchs began to move away from the Bahamas and into the Florida Keys. Largely, the big exodus came with the after Florida and the Florida Territory became a U.S. territory in 1821. Shortly thereafter, because the Florida Reef was also considered part of that transaction, and a lot of what was going on along the reef was wrecking. And the wreckers were the guys who first cruised up and down the reef. They salvaged boats. They were really the first responders of their day. There was no Coast Guard. There was no Towboat US.
So a few of them caused the wrecks too. Right?
That's one of those stories. You know, they're often considered little better than pirates, but there's not a lot of verification, a lot of documentation about that actually happening. Perhaps because in 1823 it was made illegal through the first Wrecking Act to raise false lights and draw these ships off on direct. So it probably happened prior to the American territory becoming an American territory. Mm-hmm. But the wreckers in those days, they were either working out of Havana, and the Spanish wreckers were bringing the cargo back to Havana, and then, you know, Spain was reaping the benefits of this cargo. And then the English wreckers were working out of Nassau and then bringing all that cargo back to Nassau. So one of the things that the U.S. did, because they understood how valuable the wrecking industry was and all the money being wrecked on the Florida Reef taken to other countries, they decided to make it illegal to, if you're going to work on an American territory, you had to bring that cargo to an American port of entry. And by 1823, that was Key West and that was St. Augustine. So that kind of introduces the first big influx of conchs from the Bahamas moving to Key West, because if you're going to work the reef line and you have to bring your cargo to Key West, a lot of them began to move to Key West.
At that point, you could eat conch from Florida waters.
Oh, right? Absolutely. And that was a prime food source.
And those would be harvested by just divers going out?
Well, there was, you know, back in those days, the conch was so plentiful, even in the 1940s and 1950s, when it was still, viable, you could just kind of stroll through the shallows, dragging a dinghy behind you and fill up that dinghy in a matter of hours with all these horn shells.
Wow. Now, how big were the shells? How big are we talking about?
You know, everyone's seen it. It's one of those premier tourists, you know, souvenirs you come down and you pick up, the size of a football or maybe a volleyball. That's like the queen conch. And that's really, again, Strombus gigas is, you know, that's the queen conch is really the shell that we're talking about. There are many species of conchs. The Strombus are the true conchs, the helmet conch, the fighting conch, the queen conch. There are other conch imposters, like our Florida state shell, the horse conch, which is, you know, the largest of the conchs, not really a conch. It's really a tulip shell that is, almost 2 feet long. It's the second largest marine gastropod in the world. And it, you know, really inhabits the waters around here. It's a beautiful shell, but, you know, that's one of those fake conch imposters.
Yeah. All right. I have to ask you about a term you used, the fighting conchs. Do conchs fight? I mean, is that really a thing?
Well, it's a species. Like if you walk down the beach in Sanibel or Captiva, you find those like 2 or 3 inch conch rollers that come up, you know, on the beach. And that is called the fighting conch. Although if you go to Key West High School, you're also a fighting conch, because that's that's the mascot.
But I mean, do they fight? I mean, I'm trying to picture, you know, these armored competitors coming up against each other in a ring.
They're really conch. True conchs are vegetarians, so I don't imagine I don't know why they're called fighting conchs.
Maybe you have to fight them to get them out of the shell to eat them.
It is tough to get them out.
Ah.
And that's, you know, like when people talk about cracked conch, you know, what they do is they're, you know, trying to, I posted on my Facebook group today a little story about conchs and the evolution of it, them being, you know, deemed illegal to harvest. And one of the people on my Facebook group was said, you know, back when she was a kid, her granddad would gently coax the conch out of its shell and then, you know, eat it live in front of her. And she was horrified.
oh my God.
but they are difficult to remove. That's why most of the conch shells that you pick up at souvenir stands, they have a little hole kind of by the horn. And that's where the foot is really wrapped up is kind of wrapped up in there and holds the conch in the shell. So if you can get that little creature to release its, you know, the end of its foot there, they're easier to gently coax out of their shell.
We know the term conch as it refers to a Key West native, but also this idea of a conch republic. Is that a real thing or more like
Margaritaville?
Well, you know, first off, conch is not limited just to Key West. It is the Florida Keys. I know often when people talk about the Florida Keys, they are, you know, they are focusing on Key West. And after years and years and years of being in the hospitality industry, bartending or serving, you'll be sitting at a, you know, serving a table and you'll be in Isla Mirada or Marathon or Key Largo. And you'll ask this, hey, where are you going? Oh, we're going to the Florida Keys. You've been in the Keys for over an hour. You know, this is all, it's a long string of islands. But Key West gets most of the glory for a good reason. It's a great little island and there's tons of history there. And that really is the homeland for these conchs. But one of the reasons that it's difficult to tell a Key West story or an Isla Mirada or a Marathon or a Key Largo story is because the whole island chain really is interconnected. In the early, mid, and late 1800s, these conch families were still moving from the Bahamas to the Florida Keys. And while largely they were mariners and making their living off the water, they were also farmers. And they were doing lots of farming in the Florida Keys. You know, the pineapple, for instance, became a primary cash crop. And, you know, once upon a time, 80 or 90% of all the pineapples eaten in the U.S. were, you know, grown here in the Florida Keys. And these conch families, really, that's the conduit that really connects Key West to Marathon, the Lower Keys, the Upper Keys, the Middle Keys, because these families are so extended that their bloodlines really are what connect the Florida Keys one to another. And long before the Overseas Highway and long before Henry Flagler built his railroad, the true conduit was these pioneer conch families that first arrived.
So is that the conch republic, you know, broadly speaking, is that where that term comes from?
The conch republic was really an interesting publicity stunt that was created in 1982.
You could say wacky too.
you could put Florida man all over the conch republic.
Yes.
1982, there was this, there was the war on drugs. And on the top of the, you know, there's only one road that comes in and out of the Florida Keys, the Overseas Highway. In late March 1982, the U.S. government had the foresight to create a border checkpoint in the state of Florida at the top of what's called the 18-mile stretch, that long strip of road that used to, the Henry Flagler's train used to run down. And they erected a border checkpoint and essentially treated the Florida Keys as if it were Canada or Mexico and required every car driving out of the Florida Keys to stop and to check for what is essentially was deemed, you know, looking for illegal aliens. But as they were looking each car for, you know, illegal aliens, they were checking suitcases and glove compartments. And back when the cars had ashtrays, you know, the ashtrays. So what they were really looking for were drugs coming out of the Florida Keys. And because of this border checkpoint, what they created was what was internationally billed as the world's largest parking lot. And the traffic.
Yeah.
And if you've ever driven from Key Largo to Florida City along that 18-mile stretch, there is not a, a lot of places to stop and have a drink of water, grab something to eat, go to the bathroom. It's just mangroves and this thin stretch of, you know, this thin stretch of roadway. And for hours and hours and hours, day after day, this traffic pileup, you know, occurred. And what it did was announce to the world that the Florida Keys are an excellent place to visit. They're beautiful. You know, it's kind of the American Caribbean. But while you were welcome to come, leaving the island chain was going to be hellacious. And, you know, food was going bad. And, you know, the fresh Key West pink shrimp were spoiling. The grouper, the yellowtail snapper, the conch was all spoiling. And the hotel rooms were emptying because nobody wanted to come to the Florida Keys. And so there was a group of people in Key West, including the Key West mayor, Dennis Wardlow, who went up to federal court in Miami trying to convince the judge to, you know, put a cease and desist order to remove this border checkpoint that had been erected. And the judge refused. Yeah. And so as Dennis Wardlow and some of his, you know, fellow Key Westers were leaving the courthouse, as you can imagine, the media had gathered at you know, because this had, you know, gone viral back in those days before there was viral stuff going on. As Dennis Wardlow, you know, left defeated by the judge, you know, he decided, you know, when reporters asked him what was going to happen, Dennis Wardlow said, "We're going to go home and secede," which is what they did. And, you know, one of the, you know, monikers or the catchphrases for the Conch Republic is, "We seceded where others have failed."
And so how long did the secession last? and was there any armed conflict?
There was a bit of an armed, you know, it's referred to as the Great Battle for the Conch Republic. And there was a big declaration down on Mallory Square. The ship, the Western Union, which was the last tall ship built in Key West, sadly, it's no longer floating, was armed with this Conch Republic army and Prime Minister Dennis Wardlow. And they had, you know, talked to the Coast Guard. This is all fun and games. This was a publicity ploy. How do we spin this horrible thing that's happening to the island chain and spin it to our advantage? So they decided to declare themselves a micronation called the Conch Republic. If you're going to treat us like a foreign nation, we are going to act like a foreign nation, and we are going to declare war on the U.S. government, all in fun. You know, as I'm talking, I'm putting up my, you know, finger quotes here. And so this tall massive, you know, this massive schooner, Western Union, goes out into the harbor armed with these militia of the Conch Republic. And there's a U.S. Coast Guard cutter out in the water. It's the Diligence. And they're well aware of what's about to happen. And the Conch Republic Army attacks the Coast Guard cutter with conch fritters and water balloons and stale Cuban bread. And the U.S. Coast Guard, you know, fires back with water hoses. And the engagement lasts about a minute. At which point, Prime Minister Wardlow and the Conch Republic Army, you know, surrender, asking for financial aid.
Of course,
because you know, $1 million or how much it was, you know, in financial aid, which never unfortunately materialized.
Still waiting for the bill. Yes,
people are still waiting for that. And that was kind of the, you know, highlight, you could say, of what went on.
Did that mockery finally convince the feds to take down the blockade?
Yeah, it disappears silently, probably in the middle of the night. You know, there's enough bad publicity going on now for the government. They decided, you know, to see the folly in their ways and not treat a portion of the U.S. as a foreign country. Mm-hmm. So kind of reopened the gateway to the Florida Keys, and things kind of went back to normal, except for the fact that now Key West and all the Florida Keys are now known as the Conch Republic, with the Queen Conch being the symbol emblazoned on that glorious blue and yellow flag that, you know, that now flies over the over the Florida Keys 24/7.
And of course, decorates millions of t-shirts for sale.
T-shirts, yes. Postcards, t-shirts, book covers, you know, you can't look anywhere without seeing, you know, that that representative.
What about the term freshwater conch? Where, what does that mean? And when did that become a popular term?
You know, I've been here 22 years. So officially, I'm a freshwater conch. You can only be a conch if you were born in the Florida Keys. The caveat to that is there's no, in order to be born in the Florida Keys outside of Key West, you have to go to the mainland to actually give birth. They still don't offer that down here, at least in the upper and middle Keys. But freshwater conch is after you've lived here, sometimes it's 7 years, sometimes it's 15 years, you have been declared a freshwater conch. But that, you don't hear much about that anymore. I think that was back in the 80s. And you don't really hear about that so much anymore. That's what that means. Mm-hmm. Conch, the people are the true conchs, the families of the Bahamians who've been here for 5, 6, 7, 8 generations, a very proud people and a very proud of being called a conch.
So Jimmy Buffett would have been a freshwater conch when he lived in the Keys.
Depends on, you know, I know he was here in the 70s. I'm not quite sure how long he actually lived down there. So if he was over 7 years, then yeah, he would have been considered a freshwater, but that kind of predated the Conch Republic. So that's a very interesting question and maybe a great topic for a column.
Or possibly a government grant to study the issue.
We started the episode talking about Jimmy Buffett. He is obviously so closely associated with the Keys, particularly Key West. Do you have a story you would like to share about him or his impact on the area, whether during his time there or after?
You know, everybody's been posting their tributes on social media and the papers, and you know, and it's everybody who lives here has some connection to Jimmy Buffett. You know, I have 25 or however many albums I have, and it was definitely when I wasn't in. You know, I came and went from Florida early on. I've been here. You know, I first came in 1989 to Captiva and Sanibel Island on the West Coast, and I was a bit of a wanderer back in those days and, you know, lived here for 6 months and moved away and came back for 2 years and moved away before I finally came and stayed. And every time I was not here, Jimmy Buffett music was kind of the reminder of what I want to get back to. But one of my favorite stories, he came down here like 6 months ago and did some his final concerts in Key West. And my column comes out on Thursday, and he just shows on Friday and Saturday. And in a column I was writing, which was not Jimmy Buffett related at all, I was talking about the song "Everybody's Talking." Everybody's talking at me, and the guy who wrote that lived on Summerlin Key, and the whole column was about Summerlin Key, which is in the lower Keys, and how he wrote that song. And I was kind of making up a story that, you know, if you happen to be driving, you know, across the bridges in Summerlin Key, and that song sticks in your head. While he has passed, his music still lives on. And then 2 days later, Jimmy Buffett opens up his shows with "Everybody's Talking." So I'm, you know, secretly or not so secretly, I am taking a little bit of credit for inspiring him to open up his last shows in Key West from a column that I wrote.
And that song was in Midnight Cowboy, wasn't
correct?
It?
Yeah,
they were trying to get to Miami.
Yeah. It's another uplifting story there. Yeah. The actual conch, the
gastropod, the shell.
Yes. How are its numbers since its population, since its you know, fishing for it has been curtailed?
I've done a lot of snorkeling. I've written a couple books about snorkeling, and they are out there. They're definitely making a comeback. And I have two really kind of cool stories about snorkeling off the beach of Bahia Honda. And that's one of the great beach snorkels in the Florida Keys. Years ago, I was out in the water snorkeling, and I came upon a kind of a curious sight. I wasn't sure what I was looking at first. And what it turned out to be was like a football-sized horse conch, which has a very orange foot or snail. And they are carnivores as opposed to the queen conch, which is an herbivore. And so I'm kind of sorting through the seagrass shallows, and I see this weird orange, bright orange thing, and I pick up the shell, and it's a horse conch feeding on like a softball size queen conch. And all that you can see are some of the spindles, some of the horns off the queen conch, kind of poking out through the foot. On another occasion, like 1 or 2 years later, I was again snorkeling down there, and I swear to God, I saw 30 or 40 queen conch in like 40 minutes.
Wow.
In the seagrass. And I hate to talk about that because invariably some knucklehead will come down and see the, and we still see them, you know, there's people are still arrested frequently going out there and harvesting queen conch. You know,
thinking,
I didn't know.
Thinking they can get away with it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. I didn't know, you know, then why are you hiding it from the FWC as they approach? So and I was, again, there's another island called Indian Key. Just a couple of years ago, I was snorkeling there with my wife. And we saw like 5 or 6 queen conch right there in the water. And 2 days later, lo and behold, some guy from Miami was arrested for harvesting 5 or 6 queen conch right from that very little island or the waters around it. But their numbers are definitely rebounding. I know in the Bahamas, where they are still being harvested, I know those populations are starting to crumble as well. And you know, Central America, a lot of the, because you can still find conch on almost every menu in the Florida Keys and in South Florida, all over Florida. Conch fritters, conch chowder, fried, you know, fried crack conch.
Are they getting it from the Bahamas then?
The Bahamas, there's an actual conch farm in the Turks and Caicos.
Wow.
So it's farm. There's a lot of farm raised conch and also from Belize and Central America. And, you know, it's only a matter of time before those populations, you know, crash as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's my feeling. And from what I've seen in the local waters, the populations are rebounding, probably not as fast as scientists, biologists would like, but not harvesting them, you know, because they aren't hard to catch. You know? They move as fast as snails. They are not hard to catch.
Forgive my ignorance, but do they help to clean the water or are they beneficial?
I don't know. Not like a sponge, you know, which is also over harvested, which definitely cleanses water or an oyster, which also does that.
Yeah.
The conch is not, I'm not a conch expert by any means. But I don't believe mostly they're grazing on seagrass, eating algae off seagrass blades and things like that.
How did the Keys evolve from, like you talk about earlier, this epicenter of wrecking ships to the global tourist hotspot it is today? Obviously that doesn't happen overnight, but how did that evolution occur?
The big first attempt was Henry Flagler bringing his railroad down. It was a great thing that he did. It wasn't a financial success. It didn't last very long. And even had the Labor Day hurricane 1935, which was the very last day that Henry Flagler's train ever ran. Even had that not had come and destroyed 40 miles of his tracks, Flagler, the QS extension of Flagler's Florida East Coast Railway was already heading towards bankruptcy. So that wasn't bringing the tons of tourists down to Key West. The Overseas Highway, the first version of it, which was built in 1928, State Road 4A, was incomplete. It was meant to bring more tourists to the Florida Keys. It was, you know, it stopped. You could drive from Miami to Lower Matacumbe Key in the Isla Mirada area. At that point, you had to take a ferry from Isla Mirada or from Lower Matacumbe down to No Name Key in the Lower Keys, and then you could drive to Key West. That was, you know, if you had bad wind, you know, high tides, that wasn't super reliable either. And it wasn't until they really built this second version of the Overseas Highway that opened in 1938 that created this solid conduit that led from the mainland to Key West that began to bring people to the Florida Keys and began to introduce tourism. It really didn't start happening until after World War II. That's when it really started to blossom. But, you know, Key West was always the epicenter of tourism, and it has since grown kind of north or since then.
Yeah. One of the terms we hear increasingly with tourism is over tourism. Amsterdam, Venice, there are some places in the world that are so popular, they are actually just crushed by tourism. Key West, if you already think it's there, it's heading in that direction. Is over, to what extent is over tourism a danger for Key West?
I think over tourism, overpopulation, and overdevelopment is already at a tipping point. It's already, there is one, let's talk about fresh water. Fresh water didn't come to the Florida Keys until 1942, when that's when the pipeline was, created from, that led from Homestead basically down to Key West. And it's, it takes about 10 days to 2 weeks for a drop of water to go from Homestead all the way to Key West.
Wow.
And it's just one 36 inch pipe. And just, several months ago, and those pipes are getting old, there was a blowout in the upper Keys. And when they tried to restrict the water to fix it, the increased pressure caused two more blowouts further up the Keys.
Oh, good Lord.
And even now, there's not, and for the last 6 months, they've been replacing this pipeline, at least in the upper Keys, in the Isla Mirada area. But it's just, we haven't had, they're still not the full, they haven't turned on the full flow yet, because they don't trust the stability of these pipes. And it's just one lane, each way. They keep building all of these hotels and all of these parks, RV parks now. Where do people go? The traffic is getting, for instance, I tend bar a couple of days a week at Robbie's Marina, which is one of those classic roadside attractions. And the day after a holiday, I get there in 15 minutes to get there, and it takes me over an hour to get home. After with the exodus of people coming up, it's people, people who live here complain about how many more houses can you build on this little string of islands where we can barely function as it is.
It's tough to be a freshwater conk if you have no fresh water.
It is difficult to be any kind of person in the Florida Keys. Yeah,
no question. Okay, if someone wants to eat conch and they're going to the Keys, where do you recommend they go?
I love the conch fritters at Conch Republic Seafood in Key West. If you're coming down Alabama Jack's at the top of that's the old road, the Cardstown Road. It's it's one of those classic dive bars. Their conch fritters are a little sweeter, a little different than everybody else's. They're world famous. You got to try those. It's kind of like key lime pie. Everybody makes it a little different. And my recommendation for anyone coming to the Keys, to try as many different kinds of key lime pie as you can, and as many kinds of conch chowder and conch fritters and fried conch or whatever kind of conch, and just to compare and contrast.
Have you ever had a bad one?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
I won't name names, but you go to some places and it's the conch fritter is lots of pepper and onion and just a smidge of a conch flake in there. It's mostly just a hush puppy with cocktail sauce.
Yeah, okay, that's a problem.
Florida Keys historian Brad Bertelli has been our guest. Thank you so much for your insight today, Brad.
I appreciate it. Thanks you so much for having me on.
Thanks. And of course, now my mouth's watering. So
it's time for some conch chowder and some key lime pie.
Yeah, definitely.
Brad, of course, mentioned key lime pie there at the end. If this episode interested you, we do have a full episode on key lime pie. We've got another Keys history episode, more expansive in scope beyond just the conch angle of it, episode on seashells and one on the overseas highway as well.
The Keys in general, just a fascinating section of Florida with stories all their own. And it's amazing to me that people only view it as, it's a tourist destination. They don't think about the history of it, but it's got quite a long and fascinating history. And some of it's even legal.
the Keys, I am so guilty of this, of associating all the Keys with Key West and using the terms interchangeably. Key West is not my bag, candidly. I'm not a big go out person, drinker, that sort of thing. And it's been 25 years at least since I've been to the Keys. Maybe not that long. I would like to go back and do more in Isla Mirada, in Key Largo, in some of the middle Keys, because these you know, and we talk, they're not going to be there long, Craig.
No, that's true. And I mean, the more people jam in there, I mean, we lose some things. We lose some of the things that make Florida precious. And, you know, welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.